From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a bar over a basket of chicken wings. And it might not seem like the most obvious place to have a conversation about spinal cord injuries and diseases in the central nervous system, but the casual atmosphere helped spark some insightful conversations about science. The scene I just set took place at a bar in Rochester, where graduate students at the University of Rochester Medical Center have launched a new group called Thinkers and Drinkers. The goal is for these students to meet up with maybe strangers, exchange for free appetizers, and talk about science. And while the students improve their science communication skills, the strangers get a lesson in science literacy. And don't we all need that right now? The program comes at a time when there's widespread mistrust of science among the American public. And some scientists worry that their profession's kind of under attack and there's a war on science. Well, surveys show Americans who say they have a great deal of confidence in science, essentially the approval rating of science, 40%, and that's been roughly the same since 1973. So this hour, we talk about science communication and if bringing a human element into scientific conversations makes a difference. Can it? And when people are moved by fear, confirmation bias, or motivated reasoning, what do we do then? How do we help people get back to facts and trusting science? Our guests for this hour include Heather Natola. Dr. Natola is a postdoctoral associate in the Department of Biomedical Genetics at URMC, co-founder of Thinkers and Drinkers. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And with us is Jesse Hogeston. Jesse is a candidate, a PhD candidate in the neuroscience graduate program at URMC and also co-founder of Thinkers and Drinkers. Jesse, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Tracy Boss. Dr. Boss is an assistant professor of microbiology and immunology and executive director for the University of Rochester Broadening Experiences and Scientific Training Program at URMC, otherwise known as You Are Best, right?
Exactly.
Nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
And Juan Vazquez, our colleague from the newsroom, popping in for just a moment to say hello as well.
This is going to sound like every conversation I have at home, probably.
Yeah, right.
Married to a scientist.
Oh, married to a scientist.
That's right.
Yes, of course. Well, that's the thing about Scott. I don't know professions.
That's there you go. See, so this is exactly what's going to be happening.
Okay.
So that's the type of
conversation. I didn't mean to belittle you, Juan.
No, that's
how
all
I feel
right.
bad.
These are the type of conversations that we have on Connections, and we're able to do this because of listener supports. And for those of you that are listening, whether you're listening live, whether you're listening later on the podcast, this is the time of the year, which is our end of fiscal year, when we start to clean up all the books and everything, and we ask for one final push of support from you. So this is how you can do that and support your local public radio station. You can call, if you're listening now, live, 800-295-9994. Make your pledge of support. If you're listening on the podcast or maybe you're listening on the stream and you can't get on the phone, you can go to WXXINews.org. You can go to WEOS.org. You can go to WRUR.org and make your pledge of support there. And if you make your pledge of support within the hour, if you're listening live, I should say, and call 800-295-9994 or go to the websites. Your pledge will be matched dollar for dollar. Thanks to, this is in memory of Anna and Maury Silver. So that is how we're going to be pledging your or doubling your dollars in memory of Anna and Maury Silver. So make that pledge of support.
You a big fan of science?
I am.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. So this is going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, science, like the approval rating of science is better than Congress. That's good.
Yes.
But that's not
saying
much.
It's not good enough either.
It's not saying much. Better than a lot of sort of public institutions. But still, I don't know, Dr. Boss. 40%? Come on here. 40% approval rating for science by the same people who probably fly in airplanes and you know, take the medicines prescribed to them and live long lives and drive cars that use scientific It's not 40%?
But
what happened here?
I think it's interesting because your colleague here, Jose, he has
Juan.
He has a wife who's a scientist. And you are not really, it didn't click in your mind that this is a person that you could talk to and speak about science. And if you'd say approval ratings, you actually, you do know people in your midst who are scientists.
Yeah, so it's all around us. And this hour, we're going to talk about the importance, not just of trusting science. I mean, you can't just yell at the public and say, trust science.
Right.
Some of it's just communication skills and becoming a better communicator. And I will tell you this, and I want to ask Heather and Jesse what they think about this. Hosting a talk show, I love talking about science, and I see a wide range in communication abilities. And, you know, you sort of you hate to say this, but over time, you start flagging in your mind the better communicators because you want not just smart people, but you want people who can really communicate to the public effectively. Because without that, there's this divide. I mean, I don't have Jesse, I don't have your training. I need you to be able to distill it to me. I don't know if spoon feed is the right word. I don't want to dumb it down so much, but communication's hard, and I think that's so important here.
It's very hard, and I think that there's a major misconception that all scientists are poor communicators. There's tons of misconceptions about us, but one of them is that, you know, we're all introverted nerds who are staying in one place, and we're trying to show people that, like Tracy said, we are, not to sound creepy, but we're around you all the time. Like, we're in your midst at a bar. Like, we're real normal people, and that's what our whole thing is trying to get at.
Right, yeah. Now, everyone listening is looking around going, is there a scientist?
among our people.
Heather, how do you feel about the importance of communication in this field, beyond just understanding the science, but the importance of communicating it?
I can't remember if it was me or the other co-founder we had who has since moved on to NPR, Maddie Sofia, who said, if science happens in a lab and no one hears about it, does it matter? And I completely agree with that, because we're working really hard. Jesse and I are working 50 hours a week trying to cure diseases. But if nobody ever hears about it, who really cares if it doesn't go anywhere? And so that's why I think it's so important for scientists to be able to communicate their research, not only to other scientists, but to the people who it will directly affect.
So how did Thinkers and Drinkers come about? How and when? What happened there?
So like I said, Maddie Sofia was one of the original founders of the club. She taught a class called Communicating Science to Diverse Audiences. And part of our final project for that class was you either had to go to the museum and do a science demo there, or you had to go to a bar and talk about science. And so I really loved that idea. I thought it was very clever. And after we did our first event, I decided to turn that into a full-time club that would exist at the University of Rochester. So with help from Tracy and Sharon McCullough, who's in the Center for Professional Development at the University of Rochester, we developed this idea where we could have funding for the club and be able to reach more people. And importantly, we also wanted to focus on training scientists to speak at different levels. So a lot of us have highly technical or esoteric theses, which are very hard to communicate. And so we worked together as a group to come up with ways to describe our research in a more accessible manner.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And you've been doing it for how long now?
I think 2.5 years.
Okay. So
1.5, right? Since last January.
I was promised there'd be no math, just science.
Clearly, we can't do math either.
So still relatively new. So Heather, Jesse, set the scene for me when you do this, what it looks like and generally how it goes.
All right. So how we plan these is usually we'll call a bar, you know, 3 weeks beforehand and just tell them, like, what our mission's about, whatever. And we've had a lot of bars actually be really interested in it, which is cool. So we'll set a date and time. Usually it's like a 2-hour span. We'll go to a bar. We'll wear our cute little matching shirts that we have on right now. And we just approach people. It's very, very casual. We didn't want it to be like we were talking down to people or anything. So we didn't want it to be like a lecture. So instead of us, you know, talking to a whole group at once, we just go around and we mingle. And the best way to do that is to be very upfront and to tell them, you know, that we're a communication club. We're working on our, you know, ability to communicate our theses. And then when somebody talks to us for like 5 minutes or so, really not a long time, we hand them our business card, and then they can go to the bar and trade it in for a free app. So everybody wins.
And you are, in the process, just practicing being able to talk about these, your thesis, in a way that is more accessible, yes?
Exactly.
Yeah, we call it like the elevator pitch, like 2 minutes to describe your thesis in words that like your grandma could understand. Yeah.
Do it. Can you do it right now?
All right.
Let's do this.
All right, so Evan, did you know that we have tons of viruses in our brains at all times?
In our brains?
In our brains, yeah.
I'm believing you. I mean, I
trust them.
So this is how poorly scientific I am. I would have said bacteria in the brain, but not virus. I don't know.
Yeah, so bacteria have been a little bit better studied because they're easier to find or easier to, I don't know. Yeah, to pick out in the brain than viruses. But our brains have tons of viruses in them, specifically herpes viruses. So that's what I'm interested in studying, is the impact that herpes viruses can have on neurodegenerative diseases, things like multiple sclerosis or things like Alzheimer's. So we all have herpes viruses in our brains, and a lot of these have actually been associated with diseases like those. So I study human herpes virus 6. It's the most common. Probably all four of us have it in our blood, and about half of us have it in our brains. So this virus has been linked to multiple sclerosis for a really, really long time. And so I'm studying the role that a certain gene in this virus can play and how it actually impacts the ability of the brain to repair itself. So something that I've found in my work is that if we express a viral gene from this virus in the cells that are responsible for repairing white matter in patients with multiple sclerosis, if we express this gene in these cells, they actually can't scoot around and get to where they need to go. So we're thinking that this might be a link between this virus and this disease.
How much time are we talking about before we see? What's the end goal here? If your research is successful, what's it look like?
My research is more about identifying a new therapeutic target. Mm-hmm. So if we, I don't know if we'll have a chance to talk about Heather's work. Heather's more focusing on therapies.
Oh, Heather's next for this.
Okay, all right. Yeah, so mine's a little bit more just identifying something that's a problem. You know, we can't make new therapeutics if we don't know what we're targeting, right?
Sure.
So in a lot of patients who have diseases like MS, their brain isn't as good as it should be at repairing itself, and we don't know why. So the goal of my work is to say, hey, we found out that this virus could be one of the reasons why people don't repair as well as they should. And then we can go target that virus and hopefully improve recovery in these patients.
This is really cool stuff. And so when you have this kind of conversation, you kind of, you say your elevator pitch as you described, do people have questions? Do you want them to sort of follow up?
Oh, yes. No, because if I'm just like, you know, talking
pontificating
at a
the
wall.
World. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, because that's one of the really cool things about this is that we're so stuck in our way of thinking about our thesis. You know, like some of us have been working, Heather's been working on her thesis she's got her doctorate now, but she's been working on the same project for 5 years. You think about something the same way for 5 years and you're not going to have as many new ideas. If somebody randomly has a question that sparks my interest in another avenue of, you know, investigation, that's awesome. And that can happen a lot, even with non-scientists.
I also wonder if there are moments where someone will ask you to clarify and you'll realize that maybe you're getting stuck in lab jargon or terminology that lay folks like me might not immediately grab onto.
Yeah, especially those of us who are in like cell biology stuff. There's so many acronyms, and we always have to stop ourselves because even though, you know, some things are going to be understandable to another scientist, they won't be to a layperson. So like when I talk about myelin, which is kind of the equivalent of white matter, most people know white matter. Most people know what that is, but not a lot of people know the term myelin. So I'll try to use white matter to replace it, or I'll teach them what myelin is. You know?
Let's just pretend some people don't even know what white matter is.
All right, so if we
like the host of the show.
No, that's totally fair because this is my favorite analogy to give. So if we think about nerves as like cables, right? You think about an electrical cable, how a signal has to pass along it. What has to surround an electrical cable to make sure the signal doesn't leak out? Something insulating, right? So myelin is what our brain provides to form insulation around our nerves, and that's what actually keeps the neuronal signals to be transmitted at the right rate and to have, you know, the right signal, because otherwise it'll just kind of leak out and you won't actually get cell-to-cell communication. So myelin is just that. It's like a kind of fatty little wrap that goes around the nerves to keep everything running smoothly.
Yeah, important.
Yeah.
See? All right, see? I got it. All right, well, there's Jesse's. Let's do yours. You ready, Heather?
I am ready. So my thesis is a little bit easier to explain because there's not as many complicated pieces. Jesse's is very cell biology heavy. Mine has been really focused on finding treatments for spinal cord injury. So currently there's almost nothing we can do for patients after they've had a spinal cord injury. There's one drug. It was rushed through the clinic, and honestly, the medical community is very torn on whether it's effective or not, because the animal studies that were done were actually done after the clinical trial, and they're really not impressive. So our lab has focused on drug repurposing, which is taking drugs that are already FDA approved, so we know they're safe and they won't cause, we know they're safe in humans, and we're trying to use those drugs to treat different diseases. So specifically, I've been looking at spinal cord injury, and we've had some success with one drug in particular. And we think it works basically by repairing what Jesse just talked about. So in a spinal cord injury, people are pretty comfortable with the idea that you lose the ability to walk or feel anything below the site of the injury. But this is for a couple of reasons. So one, you lose all the neurons in, or you don't lose them, but they die or they're damaged and they're not able to respond correctly. And these are the main cells that send the signal from your brain that says, oh, I want to lift my leg, to the muscles in your leg. And when those cells are damaged, they can't do this. In addition, we lose those cells that provide the insulating sheaths, myelin, that Jesse just talked about. and they expose these certain channels, so our drug is able to block them, and they act as fake myelin. The drug acts as fake myelin long enough for the body to be able to regenerate on its own. And so we're pretty excited about this result, and we've been sort of trying to figure out how it works. But that's getting quite into the cell biology.
All right,
so
and again, play this out for me. Into the future, if this works out the way you hope, what does it look like?
So we're really excited about this drug in particular because it's been a generic for a while, so it's very inexpensive. And we're trying to do all the preclinical studies right now in order to get it into the clinic and start treating people with it. We know it's a very safe drug. People aren't likely to have serious adverse effects from it because it's been so well studied. And we hope that we can get it into the clinic within the next probably 10 years.
Yeah, okay.
It's a good timeline.
Like, it sounds like a long time, but it's much faster than if we had developed our own drug, and then tried to get it through all the safety training, and we can jump ahead in the clinical trial phase a little bit.
Spinal cord injuries, how competitive a field is it for research to treat?
So spinal cord injury is actually a very hard field to study, and that is because humans have significantly more complicated neuroanatomy, or the way our brain and spinal cord are set up is much more complicated than most animal models. So there's a lot of things that are working in animal models right now that unfortunately haven't translated well to therapies for people. So it's a pretty competitive field. A lot of people are looking specifically at targeting certain genes in the spinal cord. One of the big issues is the spinal cord scars just like your skin. So if you get a cut in your skin, it scars. You can see the skin doesn't look the same. It leaves a mark, and the same thing happens in the spinal cord. So people have tried targeting that specifically, but the problem is we don't understand the biology of the spinal cord injury very well, so that makes it hard to treat.
Is the challenge in this field chasing possible solution finders out because they're giving up at how difficult this is? Or is it just making it take a long time to create solutions, but there's a lot of people working different angles on it?
A lot of people are working a lot of different angles. So one of the big spinal cord injury consortiums, I guess is the right word for it, is in the Miami Project at the University of Miami. And they are doing a lot of the clinical trials, a lot of cell transplants. So the idea is basically we know we're missing these important cells because they've been damaged by the injury. And so if they put them back into the body, maybe that will help. Those are in really early stage clinical trials.
So 50 years from now, what do you think happens to somebody with a significant spinal cord injury?
Well, if we're lucky and my drug works, then hopefully they're able to regain some of their function. I think the field is in a pretty good space in that there's a lot of funding for it. It actually doesn't affect that many people every year. It's only about 14,000 in the U.S. But because the people it primarily happens to are younger, it has more of an emotional attachment to it. So there's a lot more funding for it. And a lot of people are really invested in getting treatments for spinal cord injury. So hopefully in 50 years, people walk out at least better than they walked in.
Yeah.
So we're hoping for that.
How many different times have each of you done this kind of conversation with people at Thinkers and Drinkers now? I mean, just kind of guessing.
Well,
a few dozen times a piece, maybe now?
Per event, or how many events have we done?
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how many times you've done this now with people. Yeah.
You've definitely dozens.
Dozens of times.
If you count the times I'm not wearing the Thinkers and Drinkers shirt, like over 100 easily. I mean, we have a lot of non-science friends. I'm from Rochester, so I have a lot of friends in the city who didn't go to U of R with me, and they don't, you know, they're not into science. And so I've done this quite a few times for them.
How much better do you think both of you are right now today versus the first time you had to do this?
A lot. I feel very bad for the first person that got to hear my elevator pitch. It was not too cute, yeah.
They got free food out of it.
That's true.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot more jargon heavy the first time.
We're a little bit more focused on helping the other people who are joining our group. You know, I'm a fourth year. Heather's already a postdoc. So we're trying to focus on, you know, first year students coming into grad school who have never had to present their work, helping them learn how to actually communicate things.
Sure. And I wonder if you watch other scientists in various fields, and we'll talk a little bit about this as we go throughout, because one of the I don't want to call it a political hot button. Everybody knows climate science is real, but it has been more under the microscope. And do you find yourself ever watching an interview or a presentation and thinking, look, you know, dude, you're right, but you're not communicating this well? Do you find yourself frustrated at times? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people, you know, they're just so convinced in their core that they're right. And, you know, even if they are, even if they've proven everything, like, you can't just lecture somebody. That's not going to get through to them. You need to establish common ground first, and you need to listen to them. You know, that's the most important point of communication, is actually listening. And I think that, you know, a lot of people's fears about science are justified, in that, you know, you don't want to think that the, you know, world's getting warmer, stuff like that. People are afraid of it. And if we can get down on, you know, that same level and be like, yes, it's scary, we acknowledge this, you know, if we can start from there and listen to their fears about it first and then work off that, I think we're much better set to actually convince people that what we're doing is worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. You agree?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. She said it very well.
All right. Well, so we're talking science this hour. We're talking science communication. Thinkers and Drinkers happens when, by the way?
When we feel like it.
Oh, I see.
That was so true.
We aim for about quarterly, but we're super busy. We're trying to write our theses. We're trying to get data. And
you're done.
I'm working a lot harder now that I have my doctorate, right, in all honesty. I had it easy in grad school. I didn't. It was really hard.
I saw her working. It was very hard.
Yeah, it was a lot of long nights. But we try to do it about quarterly, because that's about what we have time for.
I mean,
and you have something coming up tonight.
Right? Yes, we have one coming up tonight, actually. It was a little bit of a surprise event in honor of this interview. So we will be at Marshall Street Bar and Grill from 6 to 8. And if you come talk to us, you get free nachos.
Yes.
Tonight, free nachos.
Free nachos.
Marshall Street Bar and Grill, 6 to 8.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just what's that?
You can find us because we have our shirts on. Yep. They say, ask me about my science on the back, so feel free to do so.
Navy
mm-hmm.
shirts.
Navy.
Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be talking to scientists for just a few minutes and getting free nachos. And good stuff. A lot of fun there. And we're talking about not only the way that they approach people at bars like Marshall Street, but they're going to do tonight, but the broader issue of science communication and its value to the public. And what I want to do is get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and let's have a conversation about the state of science communication. I want to ask our guests if they agree with some of their colleagues who say that science feels under attack right now, and what that means. Sometimes when people say that, they mean that sort of at the public writ large. Sometimes they mean that on the political level, giving changing political winds. And how we start to raise that number. If science has a 40% approval rating, you know, science might be impeached right now for an office. That's ridiculous. So we're going to talk about all of that and more with Heather Natola, Jesse Hogeston, and Tracy Boss. And great to have them here from the University of Rochester Medical Center in various places and platforms. And we're talking thinkers and drinkers, science communication, and more coming up. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, a lot of discussion about the Supreme Court. We're not talking about Kennedy on Friday. We are going to talk about the Janus case. It relates to union dues and membership and who has to pay and who does not. And unions worry that this Supreme Court decision could gut union membership. We'll talk about how, the possible results, freedom of speech, and a lot more Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Juan Vazquez is back in studio with us for a brief minute. Hello.
I heard free nachos, so that's why I'm here.
Tonight, not here. You only heard part of what it is.
Oh, okay.
To Marshall Street Bar and Grill tonight, 6 to 8, Thinkers and Drinkers.
They got good nachos there, so.
All right.
There you go.
And free tonight.
It's been a fun conversation.
Marshall Street's going to be so upset when like 1,000 Connections listen to show up, but I am here for the nachos. Go ahead,
and
Juan.
And for the science, too, right?
And for the science,
right.
Yes.
There you go. So listen to the conversation. It's a fantastic conversation. Hopefully you're enjoying it too. You're learning a little bit of something as well. That's what we try to do here on Connections. And we do this because we want to make sure that you're informed. And doing that also takes resources. That's dollars, of course. And we're asking for your pledge of support here on the final day, or actually I should say final days of our fiscal year as our fiscal year ends. on June 30th. You can make a pledge of support, and here's how you do it if you're listening right now. 800-295-9994. That's the number you call. You can make a pledge of support. Got a volunteer standing by. We'll take all of your information. You can also go to WXXINews.org. You can go to WEOS.org. You can go to WEOS.org and also WRUR.org. You can also go on our mobile apps, too, and make your pledge of support there. And when you do it in the next... if you're listening live, in the next about 28 minutes or so, your pledge is going to be matched dollar for dollar in memory of Anna and Maury Silver. So we thank you so much. So if you're going to make the pledge, you want to do it now so it gets matched dollar for dollar.
As always, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
See you back in the newsroom. That's Juan Vazquez on our one-day campaign here. Science, in some ways, feels mildly under attack. And you know, I don't want to make this like the war on Christmas, the war on science. Everything's a war on everything. But... you know, there was a March for Science last year, and that was coinciding with a new presidential administration. We're not going to get super political here. I think taking politics out of science is always a good goal, and I'm sure the scientists who are in the room agree that taking politics out of science is desirable, but it feels a little political. And so let me just ask the general question, and then we'll get more specific, and I'll start with Dr. Buss. Does science feel at all under assault right now?
I get that impression, yes, but also there are a lot of people that are supportive of science no matter what the political climate is, and including Congress. So that I've heard the phrase that this is really not a football to be kicked around, that science is something that is supported in all situations. Maybe not by people at the very top, but...
Okay. Jesse?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to defer to scientists on things that are of a scientific nature. And I think that that's what we're struggling with right now in terms of the administration. It's about listening to scientists, and allowing their ideas and, you know, all the work that they put into their jobs to actually inform policy. I think that there's a disconnect. You know, like we talk about keeping politics out of science, but we do need to have science inform politics. You know, science is the way that we research anything. The scientific method is how we figure out how to make any decision in terms of government. And so I think that having scientists have a voice in government is very important.
Okay. Heather?
I agree. It's a lot of scientists feel as though science can be under attack, especially if you're saying we only have a 40% approval rate, which is terrible. But I think a lot of that comes down to scientists not being willing to go out into the public and talk to people directly and really show that we're in this because we love science. We're in this because we want to make the world a better place. And if we're sitting up there in this perceived ivory tower, then that's on us. We need to be out there talking, and that's basically why we're doing what we're doing.
All right, let me grab a phone call as we get more into this. And this is Edward in Rochester. Go ahead, Edward.
Hi, Evan. I wanted to address a concern I have. It seems that we live in a society that has a lot of focus on how can this be of value. So it really strikes me that science and exploration is about curiosity, which is not derivative of value. Yeah. It's about the value of the experience and the doing of it. When one needs to acquire funding to be able to pursue that curiosity, or people question what its value is if it doesn't provide some sort of return, it really, you know, limits the ability for science to, well, I mean, get anything done. And as a result of that, there does seem to be a bit of a ideological hijacking on two sides. One side is saying, well, science doesn't necessarily benefit us, so don't worry about that. And the other side seems to be rather entrenched about established beliefs regarding the nature of, like, black holes and the universe itself and things that are highly theoretical and there is a lot of money and entertainment surrounding. And so I kind of think that it strikes me that the issue of approval may have to do with the jaded nature of the connection between money and curiosity.
All right, so
the purpose.
Edward, I want to follow up on one point with you before I kick it over to our guests, because there's a lot wound up in this question, and it's really important stuff. So, Edward, I saw a conversation recently among scientists who were kicking around the question, should there be any research into scientific exploration that will always and only be theoretical? I mean, some of the, and now it's way beyond my pay grade, but we're talking about some research into sort of what I would call, oh God, this is going to be the worst representation, deep space and these kinds of concepts that may never reach the level of provability. And again, all the scientists out there are just cringing at my construction here. But essentially, they were having a conversation: should they be spending time researching, thinking about spending their valuable hours of the day on subjects that will probably only be theoretical? I wonder how you feel about that, Edward. It sounds like you're mildly annoyed with the emphasis with that, or am I wrong?
No, actually, not at all. Although I do kind of get this impression that from a perspective of space travel and establishing theories regarding gravity, there seems to be this disregard to electrical energy. I've been spending a fair amount of time looking into a thing called the Thunderbolts Project, and a man who is working for NASA called Walt Thornhill, whose ideas about Birkeland currents, having more to do with the nature of the gravitational anomalies that we're experiencing or potentially observing than just gravitational effects themselves, or rather that one begets the other and the electricity is the primary. So, you know, I think that theoretical exploration is invaluable, mm-hmm. but there also is this tendency to get caught up in what we think we know and then stop looking around, which seems right. to be exactly the point of this conversation, which is that scientists are stepping away from the laboratory and the jargon to get outside intuitive opinions. And I think that's necessary. And my point about the group of individuals, and I kind of think Bill Nye and Star Talk and a gentleman like that.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, exactly. A little entrenched in their perspectives and their jargon, and maybe not incorporating outside opinions. Maybe they should be doing this exact sort of thing.
Yeah, Edward, thank you. A lot of really good stuff there, and I'll just let our guests kind of take it where they want to, and then I'll follow up on various threads here, but I appreciate the phone call. I'll start with Tracy. Go ahead.
So one thing that we hear a lot of talk about is should we focus on translational science, of the idea of that the good science is the stuff that can get into the patients quite quickly, and these are the things that we should be going after. But one experience that I had when I was in my training, the idea of we've got magnetic resonance imaging in hospitals, and that came from physics experiments in determining like nuclear magnetic resonance. So you'd think that at that point you'd be like, why are these physicists studying these things? What good is it going to be? And it did have some good. It just took a while to figure out with the basic science how then it would be applicable to people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jesse?
I mean, I am so the last person that should comment on this because my physics background is like nearly nothing. But I mean, I think that stuff is completely worthwhile to study. I think if people are worried about the worth of, you know, where their tax dollars are going, I would just compare it with other things our tax dollars are going to. You know, like I'm not going to say that it's invaluable. I think that it informs everything we do, you know. And me and Heather are very translationally focused, I think, in what we do.
Is there, as Edward brought up, and again, more on this in a moment, but let me at least broach this. Is there pressure to create a return on investment in science?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Too much pressure.
I mean,
it might. Our field is very, we're both in translational sciences. So mm-hmm. when we propose I have a drug that I want to use in spinal cord injury, when we write grants for that, people want to see results that, yes, this is working. But I can't speak for other less directly translational fields.
Right.
I know yeast biologists or there have been comments about like, oh my gosh, people are doing fruit fly research. That's actually completely invaluable for cancer research because the genes that we change in fruit flies will then we'll find out are important for cancers, and you can make drugs to target it. So even though it doesn't sound directly applicable when you're listening to it at the surface level, mm-hmm. I think if scientists were better at communicating mm-hmm. why their stuff is important, then maybe there wouldn't be this perception that we're just wasting tax dollars.
Right. This is something that we're trying to kind of broaden in our own group too, because, you know, we are a group of people who know each other because we're in, you know, departments that are the same. We're in biomedical genetics, we're in neuroscience, but we're really interested in reaching across the university to actually talk to physics students and, you know, basic chemistry and basic biology students. And because I think that they would do a much better job, obviously, at explaining their own work than us. And I think that that is very important to convince people that there is value in what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay,
and,
Tracy.
And the idea of different funding agencies. So a lot of times some of the work that is more translational, you would ask for funding from one type of agency, mm-hmm. while some of the more exploratory or discovery or high risk, perhaps, you would go to different types of funding agencies. So you can learn how to, what is your best option.
Mm-hmm. Let me get Amanda on the phone next. Hi, Amanda, go ahead.
Hi. I was just calling in as a theoretical mathematician to pipe up and say all the underpinnings of, you know, credit card security and email and computing, all those things were all worked out as totally theoretical topics before they were, and, you know, open-ended research that had no application whatsoever prior to being used in the modern day world.
That's really important. And can I ask you a quick follow-up, Amanda?
Yeah.
Because I remember a long car ride I had with another math professor that I know. And he's a very, very, so well beyond my intelligence understanding. And he was describing some of the work he was doing in research. And finally, halfway through this car ride, I said, this is amazing. What's the practical application? And he said, I don't think there is any. And I said, really? Like nothing ever? And he said, probably not. And you know, I actually exited that conversation thinking, even if there's not, knowledge for the sake of knowledge is beautiful. I think that there's something still valuable about knowledge gained, but I still wasn't convinced that there wouldn't eventually be some practical application. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like, Amanda, you're kind of reminding us that what starts off as theoretical may eventually be more practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all I really called in to say. I mean, things like, you know, general relativity worked out totally in the abstract for the sake of understanding our world, just beautiful physics and mathematics used every day in GPS, you know? I mean, I think that it's hard to deny that you can't guess at the time that you're working on something completely theoretical and unapplied what might find application 100 or 200 or 1,000 years down the line. So
well
just
said.
Just calling in to advocate for open-ended creative research.
I love it. Thank you, Amanda.
Yes.
Nice.
All right. Have a nice day. Thanks for a great show today.
All right. So that's such a good point, too. But I'm going to stick with my position, which is even if it's theoretical in perpetuity, I think knowledge for the sake of knowledge. It's one of the great, great things about human beings, our ability to understand our world better. And I find tremendous value with that. Thank you, Amanda. Let's hit a different angle of what Edward was bringing up briefly. And this is going to get a little bit lower level, but this is much more of what you're going to encounter, and you've probably encountered quite often. It comes up in the climate debate, but it comes up in conversations about science funding. If there is a suspicion that the public has about science, it's that it's somehow venal or tied to money, and that it's just following the money, you know, and that's why you keep saying climate change is real. It's because, you know, there's money behind it. And look, I don't mean to lampoon, because there's a lot of people who have that suspicion. Mm-hmm. So let's meet ahead on. So Heather, you're at the bar and you're having a nice conversation and someone says, thanks for the nachos. Cool work you're doing. But I'm sorry. I just think so much of science just chases the money and it's not really about the truth.
I would like to counter with most of us make very little money.
I want to show this person my paycheck.
Yeah, they're quite low considering the time and energy that we put into all of the work that we do. I would agree. I mean, we do sort of chase the money. We have to chase the grant money because the public and the government and different funding agencies decide what money goes where. And so if your field dries up and all the money goes away, you have to sort of chase the grant money. But I would say very few scientists get into it for the money.
Okay. And when you say to some degree you have to chase the money, what I'm hearing is you have to chase the money that is available for prioritized research in different fields.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than the construct I'm offering, which is somebody is going to say, look, the government is saying we want to say climate change is real. Here's a bunch of money. Go give me some science that shows it. You know, which is not how it...
Yeah, that's an important issue that we need to talk about, though. The idea that scientists are out to prove something. Like, that is a major flaw in thinking about it, because if you're trying to prove something, you're going to get confirmation bias, right? You're only going to find things that actually prove what you're trying to say. And that's absolutely not what we do. what we're definitely not trained to do as PhD students.
And so you're not taking marching orders from ideological lawmakers who simply want to prove or disprove or continue their agenda, and therefore you're going to quote-unquote do science, does the bidding of lawmakers. That is not a thing.
No.
Tracy?
No. Not really. And in fact, we know personally some people that have been working on, say, antibiotic resistance and the idea of when penicillin came out, oh, now we don't need any more drugs because everything is covered. But we know that that is not true. People continue to work even though they say the job is done. People, the scientists, they do want to move forward and find new things just because the discovery aspect. And then more is always better. How can you help people? How can you make these things better? Optimization.
The public also offers some suspicion that scientists just want to make a name for themselves. And so on the climate side, one of the fallbacks for me is always, well, if you want to make a name for yourself, be the person to poke a hole in commonly held ideas.
Yeah.
Be the person who shows that this is not actually correct.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists spend a lot of time trying to poke holes in each other's work for good reason, right? I mean, that's part of the process, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
you want to kill the hypothesis.
Yep, the point that you learn as a scientist is you're actually supposed to disprove your hypothesis. As Jesse was saying, if you're trying to prove your hypothesis, you're going to find the data that fits it. But if you're actively saying, well, I think this is right, but these are all the ways I could make sure to test it by saying this is an alternative. And so we're really never trying to set out to prove a hypothesis.
Also, it would be super, super dangerous because we do know a lot of scientists specifically because they've falsified something. So, like, you know, the people think that there's a link between vaccines and autism. That paper was debunked. That researcher is forever the guy who got debunked. You don't want to be that person. So we're not out here to try to prove something that's actually false because it would, in fact, ruin our career.
Yeah, this is not like a Wall Street investor who, if they blow up and ruin someone's investment portfolio one time, they're actually considered safer because the idea is you're not going to blow up twice. No, in science,
no.
Like what you're talking about with the autism vaccine controversy, that is a forever stigma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And okay, an important distinction there. But Tracy, we hear this a lot. There's this suspicion, and I think it's important to keep in mind that scientists are like any human being.
Right.
There are going to be some flawed mm-hmm. people or motivations. And I mean, there's going to be some outlier of general badness. but that doesn't mean that the field of science is sort of invalidated.
No, and most of the people that we interact with, we really are out to look for the truth, if you will. And we work with teams. It's not the picture of a scientist working alone in their laboratory at night. That doesn't exist.
You get nothing done.
Right, exactly. So there are teams of people, and the idea of peer review, you have to publish your work, and your colleagues and peers are reviewing your work, and so you have to prove it to some of the top-notch scientists that are working on things similar to you.
Mm-hmm. All right, so how do you respond? You're in the bar, you're hanging out, you're having free nachos tonight, 6 to 8 at where?
Marshall Street Bar and Grill.
Marshall Street Bar and Grill, where the whole world is going for thinkers and drinkers tonight. And, you know, someone comes up to you and they're saying, well, I appreciate the work you're doing, but to me, science is just like another religion.
Why do you feel that way?
So we're going to do the hypothetical conversation. Because, you know, I believe in a deity, and I've got a religious text. It's true. You believe in your science. We each believe our own things. Science is a lot like religion.
I think science is built on the idea that you have to trust the people that come before you. Because the foundation for all of my research relies on other people doing studies that were then peer-reviewed. So for me, spinal cord injury, other spinal cord injury biologists read the previous work and said, yep, I agree with you. I can see you have shown that when we give this drug, this animal has this behavior, and that results in this improved outcome. And I should then be able to, in my own lab, do exactly what they did. So that's the methods part of a scientific paper, and copy exactly what they're doing. So we have a very strong basis for everything that we do. So we're not just blindly believing everything that we read. We are actually able to go through and test the hypothesis.
Okay. Yeah. Does that like work for you?
Yeah. It's like my favorite, I think it's a Neil deGrasse Tyson quote. He says, the cool thing about facts is that they're true no matter whether you believe in them or not. So I think that's a really important difference, is that we do go through all of this stuff to, like Tracy said, peer review, convince each other, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that we've put a lot of work towards really confirming the ideas that we believe.
To the extent of what Jesse's talking about, that facts are true no matter what we believe. One interesting idea that was brought up to me by a scientist on a different day, not on this program, was that if we wiped out basically all human knowledge, all myths, all different religious ideas, all religious texts, all science books, all textbooks, and wiped out knowledge and started from scratch, 1,000 years from now, we would have a lot of different religions, and some they would probably be all new to us, for the most part, because there are thousands of religions out there. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the scientific facts that we understand today, 1,000 years from now, if we started from scratch, they would be the same facts. We would understand gravity in the same way. We would understand mathematics in the same way. We would we don't know how far along the line we'd be in 1,000 years, but but we would understand things roughly the same because the principles are the same. They are consistent, and they are testable. And that was a very interesting... That was a compelling idea to me that I had not thought of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we see stuff like that happening all the time. You know, there's people working on the same problems, and when they come to the same answer, you know, at two different labs, two different universities, like they're competing with each other or whatever, and they come up with the same idea. That's beautiful. Yeah. You know, you've both found out the same thing. How could you not believe it, you know?
Let me grab a phone call from Sarah in Rochester, who has a question for the panel. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi. I've noticed that when people talk about like scientific discoveries in the news, that it will be like one study with, you know, 15 participants or something like that, and it's not obviously, like, according to science, a reliable study, and it hasn't necessarily been repeated. And I'm just, so, you know, you sort of get this, the public gets the perception that, like, science is always changing, and they're, like, changing their mind all the time. And I wonder if, like, as science communicators, that's something that any of you are, like, actively working on with, like, relationships with journalism to improve that, the way that science or new studies are communicated to the through the news. In order to clarify that it's not like, you know, a fact. It's not like a new fact that is discovered in science. It's just like one particular study.
It's a great question. Yeah. Sarah, thank you for that. Let's go around the table. Start with Tracy. Go ahead.
Yeah, because the idea, I think this is sometimes where the perception of people don't trust scientists, because sometimes, like she says, they put out a very small study with an idea, and people really do want to share their ideas. And so they will have to follow up with that, but they want to put out what they have seen with their, say, 15 patients. And to put out a new idea is, as you say, very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And if it's something new to change the dogma, they want to say, this is something we need to follow up with. So there has to be a way to say or explain to the public that this is a new idea that we have and we need to follow up with this. But it's pretty game-changing if this holds.
Whereas the media, and I say this, I mean, absolutely couldn't agree with Sarah more that the media can be very frustrating. And I've been there. I've made mistakes myself. The media does want to sometimes put up a flashy headline, cure for Alzheimer's in reach, those kinds of things. When you're taking a small study or something that is one step down a long road of research that needs a lot bigger sample size and a lot more work, the media does want a headline out of it. I mean, everybody wants something exciting. And so to Sarah's point, I wonder how Jesse and Heather feel about that.
Yeah, I think that the media creates a kind of an unrealistic expectation of what a scientific study should look like, you know? Like, we're very comfortable as scientists talking to each other and saying, my results suggest this, or this suggests that we should change our thoughts on this certain dogma or whatever. But I don't think that the public is as comfortable talking about things, you know, in the same way that we do. We understand that science is always changing. We do know that facts will come out of it in the long run. But I think that because the media is trying to pick, you know, the sexy story or whatever and say that we have a cure for this or a cure for that, that people expect us to really quickly be going through these things. And that's just not how science works. You know, science needs to be repeated by independent labs in different parts of the country and stuff. And that's what we do try to do. But we get, you know, a very kind of spotlight from the media on certain things without showing the big picture.
Sure. Or I think, Heather, if the idea is, well, how come this bit of research or this work that you're doing didn't create, you know, sort of the grand fix of something. Science is probably a lot of success and a lot of failure and a lot of dead ends before you find where you need to go. And the media seems to be a little bit more like, well, what's going on there? Scientists, do science.
I completely agree. So in my own personal experience, nothing I did as a graduate student worked until my third year. So that's 3 full years of failure until we finally hit on something that worked. So science is a lot of incremental improvements. It's not so much leaps and bounds. So with improvements in science and technology, we can get better techniques, which can get us slightly different answers, which are better because they're better informed by the newer technology. So that can be part of why science changes its mind so often. I think the other issue is, like everybody here has already said, it's a sexier title to say Alzheimer's cured than mouse had 5 fewer A-beta plaques, like something super scientific and jargony sounding doesn't have the same ring to it. People aren't going to click on it. You're not going to get the advertisers. So it's really easy to overinterpret scientific studies. And that's something that scientists need to be better about communicating to the media, not just to individuals.
Yeah. I find that story profound. 3 years of so-called failure until you're kind of a breakthrough. It's a great reminder, though.
No, I know it's not unique. Some people do their whole PhD thesis with only negative data, and it's still beautiful data, but it just doesn't show what they thought it was going to show.
It's really great stuff this hour from our guests. I want to thank them for being here, and you can meet them tonight. Dr. Heather Natola, Jesse Hogestin are going to be there tonight, 6 to 8 at Marshall Street Bar and Grill in Rochester.
Yep.
For thinkers and drinkers. Yeah. And they'll be easy to identify. They'll be matchy-matchy tonight. So, have fun, and thank you so much for coming
thank
in
you,
and sharing
thank
about
you.
This. Yeah. Our thanks as well to Dr. Tracy Boss from You Are Best.
You the Are program. Best.
I
yep.
love that. Yep. Thank you very much for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to all the great scientific folks who built all the technology to make this show possible. We'll talk to you tomorrow.